Great, thank you. I invite the panelists to come up and take a seat, and then I invite Adair, who I believe will be posing the first question from the research delegate.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, all three of you, for these really wonderful papers. I guess this is a question directed primarily at Geert and Trevor. And I'm curious about the methodology of your work in relation to the site, because it seems clear that especially for work on digital culture, that identifying sites is an important part of the work you do. But at the same time, it sort of seems that, I mean, in terms of sites of resistance, sites of analysis, but at the same time, it's kind of easy to feel this site fatigue, as it were, because we're always finding new sites, cycling through them, they become obsolete, they become co-opted. So could you talk about that, how you work with the site and what your methodological approach to that is?
Sure. Well, first of all, my institute is probably driven by some kind of, you know, passionate feeling of the necessity for action research and that we want to shape the field. We believe that networks, you know, if you're into network cultures, then you know, you should also create the networks yourself. So these are not you know, dead objects for me. In my own work, you know, which I sometimes distinguish from the agenda of the Institute, I emphasize on the development of critical concepts. And there I'm coming close to Nico. Organized networks. Yeah, it's something that a lot of people then say, yeah, that's a great idea, and let's just put that into code, or let's just let's try to realize something of that. You know, where there's a very clear virtual and real aspect to it, and we've seen that also with let's say open source or free software. These are concepts, yeah. These are abstract concepts, and we know where they come from. And then suddenly, they become material. They become code, and then the code starts to interact with the world.
Well, I can add a short comment. So, just out of this landscape that I showed in the beginning, I just felt you know, like the question is, of course, what to focus on. And so I've, and they are very the degree of exploitation, or what I call this, like crowd milking, right? Consensual crowd milking, mm-hmm. It differs a lot. So I think, you know, it's a difference to work on Facebook or to spend time on Facebook or on other social media platforms and to try to make a living on Mechanical Turk for $2 an hour, right? So I think the urgency differs. So like this is why, how I would decide where I would focus and also put my energy in terms of these. So I would also never think about them as sort of empty sites, but always, you know, these are always people that I work with, right? I mean, it's these are relationships.
Okay. Thank you.
Friends of.
Let's take questions.
Thank you. Thanks for on this great presentation. Throughout the conference, we've been addressing the positive and negative aspects of participation, and as one of the research delegation for the conference, we've been thinking of the potential positivity of non-participation. And mm-hmm. this is a question primarily addressed to Nico Carpentier, but I can talk mm-hmm. to all of the panelists. We know many examples of community and groups that decide not to participate in some institutional participatory settings because they think that they are biased from the beginning. So my question would be, to what extent can withdrawal from a participatory framework can be an effective strategy for redressing power imbalance? And what is the threshold when non-participation can become politically meaningful as a collective practice and a vector for emancipation? Thank you.
Thanks for the brilliant question. There are a couple of answers. First of all, I would actually like to defend the right not to participate. I think that's actually a human right, and I think that is incredibly precious. There, in some cases, we've been given the impression that participation is the only and exclusive answer to all political democratic problems. I think that is structurally wrong. Participation is a key notion in involving people, but once it becomes a tyranny, as a number of authors have actually argued in development theory, once it becomes a tyranny, it actually turns against the logics of democracy itself by imposing itself. And that is structurally problematic. I think participation should always be invitational. Participation should be a possibility to enter into a process, but it should never be an obligation. And I think that that is a structural component of any kind of democratic approach towards participation. And you're absolutely right in arguing that in some cases withdrawing from a particular process can be a better solution to a particular political problem. For instance, in these cases, the borderline cases of semi-participatory or non-participatory practices that are being sold as participatory logics, withdrawal is probably the best solution. I mentioned Sherry Arenstein's ladder of participation, and that actually offers us a wide range of exactly these examples. When in the case of urban planning, people are invited to come to these meetings and they're being presented with the wonderful new way their district will look like. And then they get questions like, you do want to have a hospital, don't you? And that's not a participatory process at all. And then withdrawal and process is probably the only way out. Mm. So I think, yeah, point taken. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, and when it comes to, social media and the net, you know, I always think of the story from, I think, the early 1980s, where Professor Knuth was a professor for computer science at Stanford wrote on his webpage that after 15 years of email, he had just about enough, and he wants to be at the bottom of things and not on top of things, so he has enough of the email, he gives up. And of course, so this gesture of refusal and withdrawal is, of course, I applaud that very much, but on the other hand, of course, it is the complete, it shows all of his privilege, right? Because who can afford to do that? And so I always have very mixed feelings, why I say, well, I completely applaud a gal who says, never use Gmail again. Well, the university email of my university is Gmail. So it's like, by contract, I'm obliged to use it, and all the students. And I feel similarly about I would never recommend this sort of stance of refusal in this very narrow particular sense when it comes to the net to my students, because I also know the pressures that they will be facing, once they leave class, and if they are not present in a skillful way, they will be severely disadvantaged. And so while I, in theory, I'm, definitely there, but in practice, I'm quite hesitant.
So this is for Trevor over here. Hi. Hey. So for lawyers, the concept of labor has a fairly specific set of meanings associated with it, and they revolve around representation and process. Which is kind of a stylized, formalized mode of participation. And I think one of the reasons that's so, it strikes me listening to you, is because that process sort of unfolds against a background that's taken for granted, and the background condition that's taken for granted is employment. But of course, employment, right, is an industrial artifact. Employment presupposes firms, right? It presupposes employers. And so what I thought was really striking about your talk is that you're sort of inviting us to envision labor without employment, right? When you have firms occupying a less pronounced role and thus less employment, it's not that you don't have labor, it's that labor needs to be reimagined. And you didn't say that much about what you think that ought to look like. Feedback is nice, and so if you go, like if you were to go read economics, right, and you read Hirschman's Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, right, feedback is voice, but feedback is an organization. So I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about what you think labor without employment would look like.
Well, I don't think it's the future. I think it's already in place, right? I mean, what I was talking about is what 10 million people face right now, right? So Jeff Coey, who wrote an op-ed in the New York Times recently about an anniversary of the National Labor Standards Act, argued that, you know, maybe one way out of this dilemma, because the dilemma is clearly there because of the definition of employment, which is quite narrow, right? So, and often distributed labor, distributed workers are not included, right? So you can't actually, let's say, unionize, for example, because if you, cases against that. But like what Coey suggested was basically to widen the definition and make it more inclusive so that basically you have more people again covered by this term employee, right, that are now out in the cold, basically. Right, because now it's basically the definition is that of an independent contractor for all of these people. So there are lawsuits. There's like one famous one, Audley versus Crowdflower, and where Christopher Audley sued for minimum wages and for a recognition of the fact that he's actually an employee rather than an independent contractor. And so, while I think we discussed this before, I don't think this has much of a chance in this particular case. When many people bring those cases, perhaps one judge will just decide differently, which would have a shift in the entire industry globally, right?
Yeah, I'd like to add one level there, which I haven't really heard many people yet talking about, but that is the shift, let's say, from citizens or workers in their subject status to becoming a user. And for instance, the workers, in your case, you could say, well, they are at least they are users of a system. Yeah? Maybe that we cannot qualify them, you know, as laborers or contractors because they don't have a contract, for instance, or because there's. But so I'm quite interested in this new let's say status of the user, the subject as the user, but also the user. In participatory way, mm-hmm. And so everybody who is these days participating has to become by default become a user. You have to register somewhere. You have to and so on. So
let's take two very brief questions, and then we'll have to wrap it up. And we'll do the questions side by side, and you guys can answer briefly.
Thank you. My name is Sam Tota. I loved your presentations. My question is basically that you are from three different countries, you speak different languages. Are you assuming that by using the word participation or any other word, power especially, that we are all in the same bag? That's the question. Are you assuming that we are all the same, we understand the same way, and we try to be the same with despite our many differences? That's the thing. That's my question.
Thank you. Very quickly, this is for Nico Carpentier, this question. I'd like to ask you if you could elaborate more on the distinction between participation and interactivity, just because I think there is a need to rethink interactivity in terms of politics, in terms of power, and in terms of, so that's it.
Shall I start, gentlemen? Maybe to go to the second question first. One of the reasons I started thinking about this distinction between interaction and participation was that I was working for what was called a center of expertise in cultural participation. And those people were very concerned about what I would now call arts access. But that was labeled participation. So people that were standing in front of a painting in a museum, they were participating for some reason. And almost organically, very intuitively, I resisted to that definition. I could simply not accept that that was a participatory moment. And I started thinking about the fact that a person standing in front of a painting does have access to that painting, and that person will provide an interpretation of what he or she is seeing. There is a moment of interaction between the person and that painting. There is a social communicative relationship between being established between the person and, say, the text in a cultural studies meaning of the notion of text. So that's a moment of interaction. Has that person any way to make a decision? Hardly. It can be a vandal, sure. The person can leave, sure. But that's not really a very, very strong power base. And there we move into very, very minimal versions of participation. I would argue we actually have a moment of interaction, but there's not a strong moment of decision-making. Now, what I'm not arguing is that interactions is without any kind of power logics. That's a different debate that I don't want to go into, but there is a decision-making moment which, for me, is part of the definition of participation. And that brings me automatically to the second question, because I think that, for one thing, what I've actually used as a starting point is that basically everybody understands participation and power differently. And we need to look at these differences and we need to analyze them. And what I try to come up with is my reading of that struggle between the different positions. And that is obviously my reading. Other people have made very different readings, but at least, to my defense, I could argue that I very strongly incorporate the diversity which is part of the conceptual logics of participation and power itself.
Comments about that? Okay, well, that was really fantastic. Let's thank our panelists and take a small break and come back in about 10 minutes for our final keynote.